I'm Tina Casagrand. I'm the publisher and editor of the New Territory magazine. And we are missing a panelist, but we have subbed out. Camila Adams could not make it. She is sick today. But later we'll be joined by Dale Willman, who, in addition to many SEJ responsibilities, formerly ran a podcast for Slate, and also started his own online newspaper, which ran for 2 years. So it's pretty rad, too. Dale Willman, W-I-L-L-M-A-N. You'll see him. Oh, he has a good voice. He has a good podcast voice. So he's actually taking care of recording all of the sessions today. So he'll fly in. You'll see him. It's not just some random stranger. Yeah. Come on in. It's 9:05. Do you want to just get this started?
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. All right, I am joined today for now by Steve Katz, publisher of Mother Jones magazine, and Beth Daly, the director of strategic development for Inside Climate News. So I'm very excited to hear from them about new media business models. I think we're going to intro for a few minutes. I'll have some questions, and then really I want to open it up as much as possible to questions from the audience. So, and just a reminder, please speak into the microphone because we are recording. And repeat questions from the audience.
Hi, my name is Steve Katz. I'm a publisher at Mother Jones. I've been there since 2003. I want to thank SEJ for a great conference and the air conditioning for making my voice sound like a frog. So if I start like wheezing and sneezing, I apologize. Just by way of introduction, I guess there were a couple of things I wanted to touch on. Mother Jones is from the very beginning, 1976, was founded as a not-for-profit, 501c3, and from the beginning has really relied substantially on various kinds of reader support for its financial viability. Today, 70% of our total revenues, we have a budget of about $16 million a year now. 70% comes from either subscriptions or donations. And we've got about, we're still putting out the magazine. That's a device, plot device one here. So $12, crazy price to subscribe. You can get a digital copy too. And we've got about 200,000 paying readers for the magazine. That's held pretty steady over the years. It actually bumped up a little bit this year thanks to 45, and it's about 220 this year. And about 50,000 annual donors who give a gift of some size, usually 25 to 50 bucks or something like that each year. So reader support really is key to us. The balance of our revenues these days is split between foundations and advertising. Foundations about 15% and advertising about 15%. It works for us. And we think it's one way in which journalism that has a mission, that has a clearly defined community of support, and that needs to be focused on the long run, can sustain itself. There are disadvantages to a nonprofit model, but for us there are huge advantages. So two things I wanted to mention, about half of our audience comes from social media, primarily Facebook and Twitter these days. So the consequence of that is that our audience demographic online is quite a bit younger than the readership for the magazine, which is a good thing. We can see a way to the future there as long as Facebook behaves. We can talk a lot about that too. The other thing, just how a little bit about me and what I do now. In a nonprofit setting, a publisher basically means go find the money. I was hired back in 2003 to do that. I'm not a journalist. I don't play one anywhere. I didn't grow up in the media, but I've been involved in nonprofit organizational work for many years now. in the arts, community organizing, and environmental work for many years as well. And then in, since 2003 here at Mother Jones. And I used to, you know, read the magazine when it came out back in the mid-70s and loved it. And then, like a lot of people, kind of faded away and then came back in as I started to work here. And so I spend most of my time these days actually on a really cool project that we might touch on. We launched this big campaign to raise a bunch of money on top of our annual giving called the Moment for Mother Jones. It's a classic capital campaign. To our knowledge, it's the first capital campaign for a nonprofit journalism organization outside of public media. And our goal is to raise $25 million to grow. Because one of the problems with nonprofit journalism, it's hard to get access to capital to grow. So we've decided to go all in on our philanthropic work and appeal to our donors to help us in, ask them to help us invest in a wide range of growth initiatives for the organization. The target for the project is $25 million, and we're about halfway there. So I wake up in the morning thinking about how we're going to get that other half.
When did you start?
We started at the beginning of 2016.
Oh, that's great.
So I'll stop there.
Oh, interesting. Hi, I'm Beth Daly. I sort of have a different background, which I'll tell you about. And I joined Inside Climate News about 7 or 8 months ago as it's a new position, Director of Strategic Development. I was a longtime environment reporter at the Boston Globe. And then did a fellowship and became really interested in nonprofit media at a Knight Fellowship. And came back and stayed another year and quit and began working for a nonprofit news outlet in Boston called the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, where I wrote a lot. I also became really interested in different business models to sustain nonprofit journalism. And lo and behold, I found myself talking to David Sassoon, who is a publisher and founder of Inside Climate News, and now I'm here trying to raise money. And let me tell you a little bit about Inside Climate News. We're primarily foundation funded right now, and we want to change that. We know we'll always need to rely on foundations, and we're grateful and that we have many foundations and loyal foundations who support our work and think we're doing great journalism. But we need to change that so we can sustain and frankly, be around hopefully permanently. So we're trying to throw a lot of things up against the wall. We're starting a classic membership program through a collaborative thing called News Hub, and I can talk about that. That's growing out of the Institute for Nonprofit News, which is very helpful. It's really teaching us how to fundraise, frankly, for our readers and our subscribers, small members. And if we can talk a lot about that, but it is like ask often, you know, and you get money. That's what I'm learning. We're going after, again, classically high wealth individuals who care about our work. We're also doing a couple other interesting things. We started a corporate sponsorship program where we're not doing – it's not a classic corporate sponsorship program, but we have – you know, businesses that are aligned and brands aligned with sort of what we do, who want to support us and find value in knowing, in having our readers know that they're there. So this includes, we have Timberland, North Face, Seventh Generation just joined us, and a few others, and we're trying to get more to really, you know, kind of help even out the diversify our revenue stream. And even more wacky, we just got a grant last week, actually. We're going to start piloting a high school journalism program, which is sort of my baby I'm very proud of, because it fits in with our mission. Our mission has grown to not just do great environmental journalism, but to really start training the next generation of environmental journalists and helping train journalists in around the country, because we all know it, that environmental journalism has been hollowed out, particularly in the middle of the country, in a very profound way. So we're starting a high school journalism camp. It's going to be piloted in New York City this summer, a day program. And it'll include both really talented high school kids who really want to pursue environmental journalism. There'll be financial aid scholarships, but it's also going to be a revenue driver for us, we hope. And we're building off a model from my last organization at the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, where we built up a high school journalism program in the 3 years we were there that would actually bring in hundreds of thousands of dollars in revenue that would support our journalism. So we're really trying to – there's a bunch of other things we're doing, but I'll leave it at those three right now. But, yeah, we're trying a bunch of different things.
Got it.
Good morning. I'm Dale Willman, a digital subscriber to Mother Jones on Kindle, which doesn't work real well, but it's a Kindle issue, not a Mother Jones issue. I want to make that clear. But proud to be a subscriber. I'm pinch hitting for someone who was sick this morning, but I think that I can bring a really different voice here. I love what they're going to have to say today, but I have to say I have a lot of frustration with the conversation about funding the new media models right now, because it focuses heavily on national outlets. And most people I talk to are thinking about starting smaller outlets, and the model doesn't necessarily translate. So the national conversation in CJR and a lot of the other places is focused on this, which is great and an important conversation, but it doesn't help people doing small models. So my background is really varied. I worked a long time at NPR as a reporter, producer, news anchor, and editor. I've worked at CBS and CNN, but the last almost 20 years I've lived in a small town in upstate New York, and I've done a lot of different things. My current job is with CUNY Graduate School doing a resilience fellowship for journalists. But I had podcasted for Slate.com and can speak a little bit about models for podcasting and what some of what Slate had done back then. But I also founded and ran an online newspaper in my hometown a few years ago and ran that for a couple of years until we had to fold it because we didn't make money. But the discussion locally always comes up with how you can't make money. Our problem was a partnership problem, and I picked the wrong partner as a business partner who couldn't implement all the schemes that we had. But we had a lot of great ideas that I think would have made us quite sustainable had we been able to implement even one of them, and we never did over 2 years. So I can speak to what we tried to do and what might have worked and what might not have worked for us. The one slight thing is I'm also doing the recordings here, so I have to leave right now and check everything, then I'll be right back. So hopefully I'll only be gone 5 minutes. But I'm looking forward to this conversation because I think it's a really critical one to have.
All right. Thanks, Dale. All right, so I wanted first to talk a little bit about and when you think about a business model, you have to identify like your revenue streams, but also your audience, and once you identify your audience, how you can reach your audience. And so I think that's something that I myself, as I was starting my own publication, and I know from other people doing media organizations, they think, well, everybody should be interested in my environmental journalism idea or story because environment affects everyone. But that's not realistic, right? And like you're not going to reach everyone, and not everyone is going to read or listen to your thing. So I'm wondering how you guys think about your audience, what you know about them, and how that may help you get those Facebook ads or reach out to them as members. So can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure.
So there's a traditional audience for Mother Jones, especially folks who came into our orbit through the magazine. And I guess I'd have to say they look a lot like me. And a certain generational experience and background, and that's great. I'm happy with myself reading Mother Jones. But we've really tried to go beyond that on the digital side. So we've been through this transition in the last 12 years or so from a print-led to a digital-first shop. And at this point, we really are a digital-first organization. Our audience online is like 12 million people a month who are reading our stuff somewhere, somehow, either on the site or they're grabbing it on Facebook or Twitter. So who are those people is always of great interest to us. And it's a work in progress at this point to understand why people read what they read of Mother Jones. It's not the same as our print readership. As I said, it's quite a bit younger. It is somewhat more diverse in terms of self-identified partisan identification, and location actually is more distributed and so on, which is good for us. That's where we want to be going forward. So our strategy on Facebook is not about friends and likes. We built that audience on Facebook by measuring the intensity of sharing on Facebook. That's our metric of success, mainly. So we want to see how far out our stories go beyond the core online readership. So there are tools that we use that give us a handle on that. Some of it comes from the Facebook tool set. Some of it is third-party tools. And we compare ourselves against other thought leader outlets that use social. And we do pretty well. So the cool thing is that that gets us beyond our choir, we think. We'd like better data on who those folks are at the outer edge of our readership. The other interesting thing is that we're engaging with people at the level of the article rather than at the organizational brand. So people have a certain definition of Mother Jones, primarily, again, those who know us from the magazine. And their sense of history, of course, a lot of people think that we were founded sometime in 1965, so that's the perfect giveaway that they don't know what they're talking about. But anyway, but on the digital side, it's all about the article that they're sharing. And so folks will click into our site from a Facebook or a Twitter link to the story, and then our project is to create pathways for them to stay on the site and do something. So maybe it's read another article. Maybe it's to sign up for a weekly newsletter on a topic that they're interested in, and give us permission then to communicate with them. And it's a kind of standard process, or to bookmark it or whatever it might be, so that then we can go back and start engaging with them. And then that triggers invitations to subscribe to the digital version of the magazine or print, and also to make a donation. So roughly, you know, overall, like 10-12% of our folks make a donation at any given time, at least based on the core readership, the print and website readership. It's obviously much, much smaller percentage when you take into account everybody who's seeing this stuff on Facebook and Twitter.
So, you know, it's funny. Inside Climate News has been really focused on the journalism part of the work, obviously. And so I'm going to tell you, we just hired our first audience and development person, Jessica Lee, who came from The Guardian. She's very good. And so I hate to say it, right? It's kind of embarrassing. We don't know exactly who our audience is, and we're trying to develop the parameters because it's great. You can say it's everyone who cares about the environment, but it's not, right? We know it's more defined, and we're going through an exercise right now to try to understand that to then attract those people. But what we do know is, like many nonprofit news sites like ours, we are the new NPR demographic, right? Like, it's the people in this room who are reading us all the time and who donate to us. I mean, that's very clear, you know, older mostly. We also are very popular with policy people in the climate world, and that maybe also seem obvious, but it's a very strong subscriber industry and people who really feel passionately about climate change. And we're very sticky. People who come to our site and subscribe tend to stick with us a really long time. And I've just been running all these. It's just kind of interesting to me, and it's all new to me, so it may not be new to anyone who does this sort of stuff. But I've been trying to figure out what retention rates, like who donated when we started this thing in 2015, this membership program, who's still donating now. And, you know, and it's a pretty good percentage. So people, once they come and understand us and know us, really like us, and they stick with us because they know not that we won a Pulitzer Prize and we're finalists for last year again, but that we consistently put out good, deep analysis on climate change. So, that's what most people get to us through social media for the most part. We do a lot of partnerships too, which I just want to take a break on. We've tried some kind of new things this year since I've been here. We're doing many more partnerships with traditional news outlets, which is a double-edged sword, frankly, because you want to develop your own brand, right? But you want to get the story out there for everyone to see. And we started a series called Middle Ground this year, where we're sending a very talented writer out to really explore climate change throughout the country without using we all know that language, right? Without using the kind of language that we're used to of dividing the right from the left. And it's been pretty successful. We had the first piece about peaches in Georgia come out. It was published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. But that And it's great. That story got a lot of play. It's going out there. We have another story coming out with, I think, a national publication in a few weeks. But we don't get the people back to our site necessarily. It's a tiny percentage from what I can tell, like minuscule. So we're still trying to figure out what works with partnership to develop our audience. And we don't have any clear answers yet. But we're still partnering with people. Like, it's going to help us. But we'll find that out.
Any questions? Developing audience?
Yeah, audience development.
It's different for us because we were a very defined audience. So I live in Saratoga Springs, New York, and our website was called Saratoga Wire. I developed it because I was fed up with our local newspaper, the Saratogian. Its slogan was, "Our name says it all," and it kind of did. But they are a legacy media who just doesn't get the need to change. So as they've lost dollars, their news hole has shrunk. So now on a good day, they'll have three articles about the local area. And the rest of the paper is made up of wire stories of what's happening with North Korea and national sports teams and a bunch of box stuff that nobody reads. I mean, literally, you read the paper in 10 minutes, which I don't because I won't subscribe because it's such a bad paper and so poorly written. And my argument when we started this was that in this modern world of this thing called the interweb, that if people want to know about North Korea, they're not coming to the Saratogian and they're not coming to Saratoga Wire. They don't care. They're coming for a strong, contextual local news. But our audience was quite defined. It's the 28,000 people who live in Saratoga. By the time we shut down, we had 20,000 monthly visitors, so we had every sentient life form in Saratoga reading us. But we also wanted to expand because we're a resort town. So we have the famous racetrack, Carly Simon. You went up to Saratoga and your horse naturally won. That's where we live. There's a six-week track season that's very famous. We have people coming in for many other things. We're at the edge of the Adirondacks. So we wanted, the goal was to expand not just to the community, but to those who like the community, visit the community, come there and recreate in the summer. And we never got that far, but I think that could have expanded our reach. But it changes the funding model because advertising rates are not going to be enough to get you anywhere. So you have to have other models of raising income. But in order to reach our people, we did a lot of things. We started out, we launched with a treasure hunt. So I forget, it was $2,500 in silver coins that we hid someplace. And we had clues at the site for two or three weeks for people to find this. And we put lawn signs up with this. And pretty much everybody was reading us by the end of that. People were so starved in our community for a good news outlet that everybody was coming and reading at that point. I mean, our reach was exponential in the first couple of months. We hit 20,000 in the first few months and sort of stayed there throughout the two-year run. So it's easier for us than it is for you guys to, A, reach an audience, define your audience, and know who's paying attention to you.
Can I just add one thing to that? Because we're also thinking a lot about who do we want to reach, and that's this is sort of the same question, but we know people who are reading us understand climate change is real and a problem, right? But we would like to reach people who, in this hollowed-out environmental journalism kind of world, to start reading stories on climate change. And so we're trying to reach out to more local news as well. And it's challenging, actually, to make those smaller partnerships. One, it's a lot more investment of time, and it's not always met with, come join us. It's sort of like suspicion, like any new outlet. So just want to mention that.
It's interesting. SCJ did a survey a few years ago of Pennsylvania news stations. The Heinz Foundation wanted to find a way to create stronger environmental journalism in Pennsylvania. So I led an effort to survey basically local news sites. And not that long ago, for local newspapers, they wouldn't share anything with the paper the next town over because that's competition. In western Pennsylvania, they didn't see it that way. We had 12 newspapers that I went and spoke to directly. The idea was to create a news, an environmental news hub. So Heinz might, they never did this, but the consideration was to hire one or two journalists who would work in that area and do environmental stories for the paper. Every one of them that I spoke to was really excited about the idea. So I think the climate is changing for that now. And I think for you guys to have those kinds of partnerships, I think the likelihood is much greater. The problem is it's a lot of work to go through that and reach all these places, maintain those relationships. So I think that's the bigger struggle you'd have.
It is too, but I think there's a difference between local and national, right? Like, we're a national outlet coming in and saying, hey, you know, work with us. And this, you know, honestly, even our reporter who's doing this Middle Ground series going to West Virginia and Texas, and, you know, you say you're from Inside Climate News, that people think you have a point of view already. So it's been challenging from that level too. But we've made some headway. So.
There is an interesting project going on right now in New Jersey that folks may know about, that the Knight Foundation and the Dodge Foundation has been supporting. That's a consortium of local online news organizations that are working together to cover the state, because New Jersey has always been in the shadow of the big New York outlets anyway, and with all the changes in the commercial model, it's just gotten worse. And so there are some national players that are part of the collaboration. Center for Investigative Reporting is providing technical support for the project, and Free Press has come in from Washington as well to help create the infrastructure for a successful project. So I think you're right. I think there are both ways. The culture is shifting big time in terms of how to make collaboration work, and a lot of experience has been earned over the years now, and where to avoid mistakes. And there are ways in which national shops can partner up with local shops. I mean, the latest example just this week was ProPublica's, you know, ginormous $3 million grant that put six reporters in different local news outlets.
But the way you describe this New Jersey one goes to Beth's question.
Yeah.
Those national outlets were providing technical support but not content? Is that right?
I don't know. See, I would imagine, I don't know for sure, but I would imagine that if there are stories with national relevance, if it was us, we'd be constantly in conversation with local editors and reporters, mm-hmm. thinking about what stories actually are give us insights into broader national trends. That would be the driver for a partnership that we would do. And we've
so feeding from the bottom up to you, as versus you're talking from top down, right? Your content going that way. Okay.
I mean, it would give the local shops a bigger venue to get their reporting out. And then, you know, I'll give you an example. We're doing a lot of reporting right now on opioids. And we've got a full-time reporter on the topic. That's a genuinely local story. I mean, you can't do it without understanding the context within which that's happening. But it's also a national story.
Do you give them any support in their reporting? the local
people?
Guidance? Well, so this is our constraint. So right now we can afford to put a reporter full-time for Mother Jones on the story. They're going to – Julia Lurie is our reporter. She's got a – editor behind her and video support as well. So it's a Mother Jones project. It's not a formal partnership with local news outlets. On the other hand, we sent a guy, AJ Vincent, to Puerto Rico last week, and he traveled with reporters from local Puerto Rican news outlets, and they were jointly putting up content from both shops. So it's just, there's lots of opportunities for that to happen, and if you get over the competitive problem, you're coming into my turf. There are really great creative solutions to make it work, national, local. And I think you're absolutely right, too. I think the local news problem is way, way more serious for us. I have the same problem with a really crappy local newspaper where I live. And to get from zero to one with a new outlet is the problem. Once you get to one, you can actually make it go. But that first step is really, I think, the tough one, to get the resources together.
But I think there's some really good things that can be done to raise that money.
Yeah.
I mean, the advantage that we have, although it's different for Mother Jones, even, I think even for an Inside Climate News, it's what's your community.
Right.
So for us, there's a geographic community. For you, it's a different community.
Right.
Mother Jones supporters are passionate supporters, so you have something you can tap into there. Slate, I think, was one of the first that started doing this with their live podcast.
Yeah.
So this is a big moneymaker for them now. So if you don't pay attention to Slate, they have the political podcast. They have several others now. And they will go live. It was in New York for quite a while, but they would sell tickets. And so there was a model. They did it just sort of as a small thing, but it became such a big deal. They now have the GabFest is what they call it. They have GabFest T-shirts that they sell, and this has become a revenue stream for them. So their podcast. A guy named Andy Bowers, who I worked with at NPR years ago, started the podcast for Slate. And with a very long game attitude. So they started them not really making money, spending a lot of money on it, but it's turned into a very strong moneymaker. And I would say that even at the local level, you could do something like that. So there are these models that can help. So you're right, getting to one is the important step, but in a small town it can be easy if you have a reputation, if you're known, and if you're doing good work. Yeah. But I would argue that there's a lot of opportunities for funding models, different ways to raise income. Membership, as you were talking about, I think can work well at a local level. If you provide added, you know, you might have a monthly gathering with one of the reporters as a benefit, but something like that.
So this is kind of off topic, but and I don't know if the person I had dinner with last night is in the room. So if she is, I apologize. But so I mentioned to her that she teaches at a university on the journalism and communication. I mentioned that from Mother Jones, and she had been involved in a. Is it you? With you, right?
I don't know.
Okay. So where the conversation went, and I actually wanted to ask folks about this, was asking for money, the gesture was putting your hand out and asking for it, felt uncomfortable, right? And so I've been doing this stuff for like 30 years. I don't have a problem anymore putting the hand out because it's actually an invitation, right? It's not a reach. And so I realized that underneath all of the business model stuff, I mean, first of all, let's be clear, there's no business model for journalism right now. It's like, let's make shit up and see what works. But underneath that, I think, is a cultural issue within the trade, which is how do we kind of grapple with our own feelings about money and the power that money has in our psyches, you know? And because it really affects the way then that we engage with people who are natural or could be natural friends of ours who increasingly recognize that journalism as an institution, a core institution of this country is at risk. And just parenthetical, I got after the election, I mean, we were getting phone calls from people and emails asking us if we were okay. It's like, yeah, we're okay. Are you okay? So, I mean, so I just, I don't know. Have people like have how many of you guys have actually asked for money? You know, and like, yeah. So you know, it's okay.
You notice no one's smiling when they raise their hand.
Yeah, but I mean, the follow on question is, we don't have to. It's like, well, how did that feel, or what are your, you know, those of you who have never done it, like, is there like a fear thing going on? It's like, oh, money, you know, dangerous, dirty. Right.
Beth, can you speak
to that as well? Right, from a traditional journalism standpoint. It's also like journalism has traditionally been a for-profit model, so you're coming at it from it was never a discussion, and it was definitely this power struggle. We held the powerful accountable, and the powerful had money, right? So like now I think a lot about this when I go out and really make an invitation, exactly. I see it as that. I really do. And I think it's a really important job. I think it's one of the most important jobs in journalism today because we can't do it alone. You know, the business model is broken and we need philanthropy to help us get our legs. And I think we will get our legs and philanthropy will probably always be there. But I do think asking philanthropy and wealthy individuals to sort of partner with us if they believe in our mission and what we're doing is inherently uncomfortable. And I tell you, I would sit with my husband and I would like role play, you know, before I had to meet someone because I know a lot of people in Boston through my years there and I have a lot of connections and I had to go out and I'm starting to make these build relationships, you know, and not ask for money right away, but let people know who we are and our values and see if we align. And I'd sit in the bedroom and I'd be like, okay, you're blah, blah. And I'm talking to you at this blah, blah club. And, you know, and he's like, oh, no, you're being too mellow, you know. Like, so, like, you know, I think it's an art in many ways because it is so uncomfortable. But I think being a journalist, I have more authenticity asking for it because I know what's at stake. And I feel like I can talk about that part, you know. Yeah, I really can. Like, I know what the mission is and it's in my DNA, you know. And so same with you.
But the interesting thing is that what I find in talking to a lot of journalists interested in doing this sort of thing is it's this reluctance to place what I think is the true value of what we do. One of my big beefs about America is we've gotten away. We don't have civics classes anymore. My daughter is taking what they call PIG, participation in government, and they teach them almost nothing about civics. So when something nasty happens with the media, we all stand up and go, First Amendment, but the public doesn't know what that means anymore. So we have a responsibility to teach them what that is. But I think also a lot of journalists have sort of been so shell-shocked that we've forgotten the importance of us, the core importance of what we do in a democracy. I just came back a while ago from spending a year in South Sudan working with journalists there, where you can really see what it means to be a free press and what that means to a nation. And so I've been thinking about this a lot. And I think that we're shell-shocked. Craigslist came in and ate our lunch. Facebook came in, and everything's sort of destroyed the model. And we're sort of so overwhelmed that I think we've forgotten the value we bring. So my partner was a 27-year-old. He had a thriving business in Saratoga. I figured I got a digital native here. He's going to be awesome. And when we started selling ads, we designed the site poorly, which is something you got to think about. He designed it when we came up with it. We wanted to have limited ads. We didn't have all these really obnoxious sort of sites. But then it wasn't flexible to add when we could sell more. So we capped ourselves way too early, and he wouldn't increase the rates. He was the business partner. He wouldn't increase the rates. And I'd say, Jonathan, we need to go here. Oh, they won't buy that. But you're not asking them. And it's important. Especially in a small town, for God's sakes. We know everybody there. I walk down the street. I know all these people. I know the business guys. It's not about a cold call. These are people that you have relationships with. So why wouldn't you leverage that to say, here's the value we bring to your community. This is why it's important, and this is why you should value it at this amount. And I think that's a really important thing to remember if you're starting a news outlet. Don't undervalue what you're doing, and that's too frequently, I think, journalists do that because we've not been on that side of it before, and now we sort of have to deal with that. Remember how significant we are to our communities and to our country.
Thank you. I'm glad it went in that direction because it answers a question that I had. One final thought on the asking process and asking for money. There's a great book by Laura Friedrichs called The Ask. Don't confuse it with Ask by Ryan Levesque. It's about sales funnels and it's terrible. But The Ask is, it's good. It gets at what Steve was talking about how personally you think about money. And then what Beth is talking about, how to rehearse and ask for it. And really ultimately, believing in your project or your mission and knowing how to communicate that to people. So if you want a book about what was just talked about in 5 minutes, look into that. All right. So my last question before we open it up to the audience, I thought about this last night. A lot of us went to the party, right? And we got a tour of the iron plant. And then in the middle of all of this industrial space was a sculpture of a stag that had a great story behind it. And our tour guide on my tour talked about how if that sculpture hadn't been made and hadn't been a draw of public art for people from all over the world, they would still just be in this cultural preservation, like we're just going to preserve the building kind of mentality. And that just like cracked open their idea of the possibilities of what that space could become and be relevant in the modern world. And it also reminded me of Seth Godin, who's a fantastic marketer. He talks about, everybody sees cows in the field, but if there were a purple cow, then you would tell your friends. But you would never say like, oh, I drove by a field today and saw some cows, right? So things have to be remarkable, meaning essentially be remarked upon. And I'm wondering, what is the most remarkable thing that you have done through your journalism that you can remember that would be kind of like a cool, inspiring thing? And maybe gold coins is it. I was excited about that. I'm going to tell people. The gold coin treasure hunt.
That's pretty cool.
So I'm not a journalist, so...
And Mother Jones, as a representative.
But remarkable in what sense?
What have people talked about? Okay. What have people talked about?
I can start.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's sort of interesting. When I joined Inside Climate News, again, I came from a really traditional background, and it struck me what Inside Climate's brand is. I mean, I'll talk about in a second, like remarkable journalism, because I think we do it every day, and it's really, really good. But what was amazing about it was like this really clear truth, and it's like Inside Climate looked at the science, the preponderance of science, and said climate change is happening, it's real, it's man-made, and we're going to report it as such. And it's such a clear, simple thing, and that's what they do. Now, mainstream press does that too, and at The Globe, I wrote many, many series on climate change, but there was the mainstream press does have, and I'm not being articulate because it's just coming to me now, but it has a way of reporting on some crises that doesn't make it sound like an urgency. And because we're often reporting what other people say, you know? So Inside Climate, what it does is just, it's not an advocacy group at all. Like, we're totally straight, but we say, look, we looked at the science, you know, and this is it. And I think mainstream press doesn't still do that as much. It's changing now, but you still see these levels of doubt sometimes that creep in where there shouldn't be doubt. There's certainly doubt in climate change. Make no, you know, bones about that. But there isn't about the fact that it's happening. So I think that's sort of our journalism. The thing that I was really struck by, they did a story about accountability in Exxon. I don't know if anyone heard about it. It had this hashtag called Exxon New, where we went back and got documents from a whistleblower that showed that Exxon actually had known that climate change was happening from the burning of fossil fuels and had come to that conclusion decades ago. And then just literally like, whoop, we're going to work to discredit that truth. And they did it again and again and again. And so that's the journalism I wasn't there for it, but I'm really proud of it because it sort of stands what Inside Climate is for.
That was a great story, an amazing story. Along the same lines, so I think in the last couple of years, the story that has really generated a lot of discussion for us and attention from Mother Jones was Shane Bauer's 4-month undercover reporting project at a private prison in Louisiana that turned into a 35,000-word essay that filled the feature well of the magazine and then was ported over onto the site and then was combined with five video vignettes from James West, our video producer, and then we collaborated with CIR Reveal to do a 1-hour audio podcast on it. And it generated Shane's been recognized with a number of awards from different journalism outfits and National Magazine Award for Best Reporter and so on. And it did begin to feed into a shift in the policies that the Obama administration through DOJ and Homeland Security was following on a private prison management. And that both DOJ and Homeland Security announced after the story was published that they would be changing their use of private prisons. It wasn't a direct consequence of the report, but I think the report signaled to the policymakers and the agencies that they were safe to make that move, given the amount of attention it got. The other thing I would say, just to close out on that, perfect example of the case for community reader support, that story, 4 months of reporting, field reporting, and then probably a year of editing, report, re-reporting, video, design and so on, probably cost $350,000-$400,000 to do that one piece. When we posted it on the site, we decided to use a format that limits the amount of display advertising on the pages. So I think we might have gotten $5,000 in advertising revenue from it. The rest of it, half came from early grants from creative grant makers who were willing to take a chance on a story that we couldn't actually predict what was going to happen, which is an amazing conversation to have with grant makers and program officers who are willing to put some risk money in early. The balance of it, the other half, came from a online fundraising campaign that we ran after the story was posted to make up the difference. So there's an example for Mother Jones of where really great content, really great reporting, you know, signature stuff for us. Nobody else was going to do that kind of piece, similar to the Exxon story that Inside Climate News did. We did that, and then it really reminded people of the value of that kind of reporting and this kind of institution.
No, I have something unrelated. But
okay. two quick ones. The Saratoga and the paper that we're competing with was known for things like they once did a report on a restaurant that had failed a health test. And it snuck in the paper, and as soon as it hit, the managing editor came into the newsroom screaming, stood on a table waving the paper and said, "These people are advertisers. Their check is good. I don't want to see this again." That's the sort of stuff. Oh, and she now is a journalism professor at SUNY Albany, which is different from CUNY at SUNY. Just make sure that's clear. So one of the things that anecdotally from everybody coming up to me when we launched was our coverage of city council, which is boring and mundane, and their reporter would rarely show up, but they would live stream it, so he would sit back in the office and watch the live stream. Their deadline at that point was 10 o'clock. It's now 8 o'clock, so they don't even get anything into the council meeting because it usually goes till midnight. And they would write, even when they were there for the whole thing, maybe 500 words. I would write 2,000, 2,500, 3,000, depending what it was. I would argue that my writing was contextual and storytelling in nature, so people would be more interested in it, but it is city council. But people valued that and appreciated that, and it began to affect change. We could track some of the things that we covered and how council began addressing them after that because they were no longer doing it in silence. And the same thing with our school board. In New York State, the way our school board works in our town is that the committees do all the work. Then they come to the public board meeting and they say yes, yes, no, and then they're done. But under New York State law, any documents they use in those committee meetings to make the decisions have to be handed out and available to the public at the board meeting. And they wouldn't do that, and they refused to do that. And I went to the superintendent, who I know, and said, "Mike, you've got to do this." "No, we don't." "Yes, it's the law." "No, it's really not." So there's an advocate in New York that I called and said, "Can you give me your ruling on this?" And I took it back to Mike, and he said, "All right." Then they started giving us a copy of it, but no one else, not the public, not anybody else. So we didn't affect a lot of change there, and I suspect they're back to the old ways now that we're not there. But our coverage of City Hall, while not the impact of this, in the community, it was a huge difference. The other one was I was at CNN, of all places, and I did a series on Beauty and the Beast on Broadway. And it's one of those stories that you sort of stumble into. We had a friend who is the harpist in the orchestra. And over dinner, she happened to mention that they were being gassed every night because Beauty and the Beast had lots of pyrotechnics. And in that theater, the way the air handling worked is it all drained off the stage into the orchestra pit. So literally, they were sitting there playing with gas masks. The violinist had one canister unscrewed and taped over playing with the gas mask. It took 6 months to get the orchestra to buy into it to let me do it. I wouldn't do it unless they agreed. And I did this story, and it altered the way Disney produced the show. So that was something that was really pretty exciting. And I won a Murrow Award for it, for investigative reporting, that they gave to me at the annual conference at Disney World. Which I thought they weren't going to let me go. But
that's great.
Did you have something to add?
I'll mention it later. Yeah, you can.
All right, I really want to open it up for questions. And again, we're going to go about 5 minutes late because we started about 5 minutes early. Just as a reminder, SEJ members and journalists first, they get priority for question asking. So I saw this hand up first, and then we'll go Joe and then Lindsay first. All right, yes, ma'am.
Is this good or bad?
Yeah, I know.
Right. Oh, cool.
Wow, somebody's doing Mother Jones.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, so one of the things that struck me was, you know, the exploding cars.
Yeah.
And then the spill of the Michigan feed. You know, somebody put fertilizer into, you know, cattle feed that then went to lousy cars. And it was significant was that Mother Jones was the only one who covered it, but was significant that about analyzing the big stories were because whistleblowers came to your magazine and said, "I want to talk to you, and I'm only going to
Right. I think I'm sure everybody on this panel has stories on that. So the question was, whistleblowers, how frequently, how often do our stories get generated by whistleblowers who come to us because they think they're going to be treated well with a story? Right. So the big spiky stories, the ones that where people recognize our role in releasing a story, often are coming from sources coming to us. So the exploding Fort Pinto story that won our first National Magazine Award back in 78, that was an insurance guy who said, you got to look into this, and he sent us the documents. I'm not familiar, actually, with the Michigan story. I want to find out about that, so that's good to know. More recently, of course, the 47% story was the bartender at the Boca Raton fundraiser for Mitt Romney was like, I don't like what he's saying. I'm going to make a video. He approached David Korn in our Washington Bureau, who had been reporting on Romney's connections to Bain Capital's investment strategy in China. And the bartender had read David's stuff and for that reason approached David with the video. And more recently, the so-called Golden Shower dossier that David published on Halloween before the election just about a year ago, again, was a source who had actually shopped a story to other outfits, including us, and in the end decided to go with us. So there's an example of how careful you need to be, especially Mother Jones, because if we do something wrong, we're going to get clobbered. And that has happened. We were sued in 2013 for defamation by an Idaho conservative billionaire who really wanted, it was pre-Gawker, but they wanted to shut us down. It was like the game plan for what happened with Gawker. And so we're very, very conscious of the threats that we face because of who we are. And so the story that David published is kind of a parenthetical. We didn't release the dossier because we couldn't confirm the information that was in it. What we could confirm was that the FBI had it and was looking into it. And so that was the story. It happened to drop the same day that the second Comey emails news story came out in the Times. And so it was completely bigfooted. And it was, you know, the story was also dismissed as a kind of, that can't be true. Well, it may be true, right? We're learning more and more as we go on. So
I just want to add, like, whistleblowers are really useful to journalists, but it's just two quick things. It's built on trust, right? Like, people trust Mother Jones. And it's not just that whistleblowers come to you. You have to build relationships up to get to actually seek out whistleblowers because they're fearful. You know, I wrote on genetic testing right before I came here for like 2 years. And, you know, I built up trust in the industry and got a whistleblower to come to me for a really big story. But it's you have to reach out as much. So that's the only thing I wanted to mention.
Okay. Do you have anything?
I was really happy to hear. I think it was the guy from Washington Post on the plenary yesterday. Talk very briefly about the responsibility that journalists have to whistleblowers. At an SEJ panel in Dallas in April, we had some folks talk about this specific thing, the care and handling of whistleblowers, because journalists get excited when a whistleblower comes to them, but we forget that they're human beings and their lives and their livelihoods are at stake, and so there's a responsibility we have. So it is about the relationship, and it's about how far you'll go with that, in protecting them and making certain they were secure. The Beauty and the Beast story, the reason it took 6 months to get buy-in is because it's weird. Musicians rarely get, you know, retirement accounts. But if you're on Broadway, it's something like after 10 years of playing on Broadway, you get this huge retirement package, apparently, some sort of benefit thing. And Broadway shows collapse all the time. So when you're on a winner like Beauty and the Beast, you don't want anything to happen. They were afraid it was going to shut down. So I spent 6 months talking to them and telling them I would not do this unless they agreed to it. I think it's important to have those kinds of relationships and respect the whistleblower as well when you're doing that. And Mother Jones has a long history of doing that, and this is why people come to them so often.
Yeah. And Beth, I appreciate you talking about trust, because I think whether you're trying to find sponsors or subscribers or members or whistleblowers, like, all of you have been fantastic about being transparent with your audience. And I think sometimes if we start a new project or something like that, or maybe I'm just speaking as a millennial, it's like everything has to look good and perfect. But you all are very honest about what your needs are in terms of funding and just in terms of like how you're going to report things. And I think that that is probably the best avenue to get revenue, I think. So anyway, we're going to go on to Joe and introduce yourself.
Joe Davis, I'm with SCJ mostly. It's back to business models for me. I'm wondering if I respect all of your individual experiences and institutional ones. Could you look for a moment for us beyond your personal situation, your group situation? What are the examples nationally, whether it's a nationwide or a regional, there are lots of successful regionals or even more local. What are the big successes nationally of innovative and sustainable business models that you might point out? And, you know, there's Politico, find a rich guy, find a really rich guy, wait for the rich guy to find you. But what's working out there?
I mean, I can. Okay. So Texas Tribune, everyone heard. So Texas Tribune is a really good success model. They're fantastic. They hold. I just was with the editor on Tuesday in Philadelphia, and they pulled in $1 million net from their annual event at the University of Texas. They hold events, they hold talks, and it's a big revenue driver, not because people pay, because they have corporate sponsors. It's a really successful model, and it's something that we're going to try too, this event model, though we're national, not local. MinPost is another really good nonprofit news site that's amazing. They actually do sell advertising, which I find stunning, you know, because selling advertising works for Mother Jones, but it doesn't work for our model yet. I'd love it to, but we're not big enough. You can throw out some others. I have some others in my head. But
yeah, I think those are really good examples in the nonprofit space. The other things that seem to be working right now in commercial online sites is a new kind of cross-subsidy. In the past, it would have been a cross-subsidy. You know, newspapers cross-subsidize their news hole with advertising, or sports would cross-subsidize investigative reporting or whatever. And they'd sell advertising against the sports stuff and then use the money and throw it into their reporting, their editorial team. So nowadays, rather than display advertising, which is a losing bet, you look at some of the newer shops, and they're using a design studio approach, either to produce sponsored advertising for clients that advertise on the site. So it's a full service, kind of a full stack service for advertisers. Or they're another model, sort of along the same lines, is they open up a design shop that goes out beyond the outlet's clientele and just serves as a design advertising studio for clients. Period. And then they use that money to make enough money to cross subsidize into the news hole. So. Well, I think Vox has one. Vice's model, besides, you know, raising a crap ton of money from private investors, is also based on that. BuzzFeed also, I think, is the same model. This is not my area of expertise, so anybody who really knows that stuff should speak up. But that's what I understand to be true.
Okay. No, I would caution that I think the industry is so far back in its heels that we're looking for that magic bullet that's going to be the one answer. And there is no one answer. I think if anything has shown us this, it's that. There's a legacy newspaper in Texas. This is Texas. There's only two states that could do this, Texas and Ohio, where football is so huge. The newspaper does play-by-play of all the area high schools, and they sell subscriptions to parents. It's like $150 a year to subscribe to get their play-by-play. And they're making, last I saw, can we say shitload? Is that okay? They're making a shitload of money doing this. That's going to work in states where football is huge. It's not going to work in Buffalo. the stuff that Texas Observer, why am I blanking on the name?
Texas Tribune.
Yeah, the stuff they're doing is incredible. They're one of the leaders. They also designed a back end for online newspapers that we used some of. They gave it away for free. They got a grant from Knight, I think, to do that. But, you know, they've been really weaving and bobbing a lot to find some ways, some really interesting ways that you can take from. But it has to be of value to your community. One of our plans was to do sort of a local TED Talks type thing. It would be a weekend starting Friday night with a big, big bash. That would be a private thing. We would have events on Saturday and Sunday at different venues. We'd sell tickets, whole venue tickets for something like $175, and then individual tickets. We'd have extra tickets for the gala on Friday. Because I worked at NPR for years, I could get a Don Gagne or somebody to come speak, which would be a big draw. It would work in Saratoga. We have Skidmore College there. The town itself has immense intellectual capital. Jeff Goodell from Rolling Stone lives there. I mean, it's a real hub for that sort of stuff. So something like that would have a great chance to work there. It wouldn't work in Poughkeepsie. You know, so that's my only caution is to say, don't look for that one thing. Look for all these different things that combined together are going to provide a very sustainable base for you. I guarantee you Inside Climate and Mother Jones are not saying, we're going to do this thing, and that's what's going to save us. I mean, you can't think that way. You've got to think creatively about who your audience is, who your community is, whether it's geographical or idea-based, and what's going to appeal to them. And be honest with them, as she's saying.
Really, really quick add is like it's really also what you can live with, right? Like an ideal world where we just do pure journalism. You know, I Texas Tribune is now doing sponsored content or advertorials, and they have it on Trib Talk, which is like their op-ed section where corporate people will write op-eds and pay for that privilege, and it's very clearly marked. They're thinking about bringing it onto their main site. Now, New York Times says this all the time. Do we know the difference? Well, yes, and they're making a lot of money from it, or significant money, I think. So, like, these kind of conversations you have to have with yourself and where you're willing to go, and we're having this similar one at Inside Climate News. Were we willing to do something like that? Anyway, just something to think about.
I like the way they're doing that, having it on that specific op-ed area. I do the Post and the Times apps, and I forget which one, but lately I've been reading articles and going, especially science-related, and going, wow, this is really slanted. And I go back to the top, and in some tiny print someplace it's sponsored. They're not identifying very well, so at least the Tribune has it clearly in a specific place.
And Joe, I'll just add real quick. Belt Magazine covers the Rust Belt. They started as an online, will like always be free, long form journalism, relying on membership. The membership isn't what made them money. They started making money when they started publishing city anthologies, which they could then sell to bookstores and online. That's where they have actually kind of pivoted and only recently are getting back into the journalism side of things.
Anthologies or collections of their stories about the
I think it's part stories, and then I've also seen like they would pull from a story that ran in the Huffington Post, but then they put it into their anthology. So check them out. The Monocle is another fantastic example. Started as a print magazine in 2007, just before the economic crash. I think they survived because they were covering global affairs, so people were interested in how that affected things. They have a lot. They have podcasts now, radio, kiosk cafes. It's fantastic. Delayed Gratification is fully subscriber supported. It banks on slow journalism. So they will publish the stories that happened in the last 3 months. But, you know, a subscription is pretty expensive. A single copy is about $20 per copy. But they've been around for at least 25, 30 issues. Steve talked about cross-subsidizing. Some smaller outlets are creating their creative studios. So they have their magazine, which kind of shows off how well they can design or how well they can do storytelling. And that's subsidized by the gigs they get off of that, where people are fans of what they do and then say, hey, can you design our annual report or something like that? In a similar vein, there's an indie soccer magazine, and its name is not coming to mind, but they have a fantastic, beautifully illustrated soccer magazine that it is more innovative in sports coverage than you might usually find. And so they get to do a beautiful thing. And then they've partnered with ESPN, and they'll like take over ESPN's issue for an issue or something like that. And they make some money off of that. So the idea is just to get really creative, like do something truly remarkable. And to also modify based on your audience, based on your area and region, and have that multi-legged stool. It can't just be like one or two sources anymore. So, I'd like to move on to Lindsay, and then hopefully we can get to a few more questions. So is the question, like, how can you both raise money and reach new audiences? And are there examples of that? Starting from the ground. Yeah. Does anybody remember the Beacon? It was an effort to try to do crowdfunding to fund journalism projects specifically. It was a great idea. But I think they have since folded. Am I correct in that? Yeah. So that's one example of something that didn't work. but I'll leave it to that.
So, you're a great newsletter. It's great. Shelly is really good. So I'm hoping you get, I saw your micro donation things, which is a smart way to go. But, you know, ask people for referrals, right? Just say, if you can't donate, you know, can you share it with five friends? You know, and that really works. It totally works. Because people who, once you get loyal readers, they want to share that. And that's a little thing, but that's something. I don't know anything else other than what we're trying to do. So.
Well, I just learned about this. Some states, their humanities councils often give grants to libraries to bring speakers in. So one small fundraiser might be that you get libraries to pay you $300 to come in and talk about stories, but the subversive aspect of it is that you're tapping into their member lists as people to come and find out about what you're doing. I think libraries are a huge place for what we try to do as an outlet of getting the word out. They're very welcome. They're very interested. I gave some talks about South Sudan when I came back, and the most widely attended were the ones in a couple libraries because they've got a lot of people who have a lot of time on their hands, who are interested and engaged in the community and in the world around them. So, and then the idea of membership is a good one, and maybe you could have meetings in other cities. So one of the things we want to do is we called coffee house conversations, and we're going to meet at this coffee shop at this day. If you're a subscriber, love to see you there. Just come chat and bring your friends. And there's a way. And then you also are exposed to all the people in the coffee shop, and you develop a relationship with the coffee shop. There's all sorts of ways of it's about creating community. And again, whether it's a community around climate or around particular progressive issues or your own community or, in your case, this bioregion that you're covering, to me it's finding ways to foster that community, not in specifically to say this is going to make my product, make a lot of money, but to say you're doing it because you want to create this community in a sense. So it's fostering that community. And then the membership and the funding comes with that. So it's a different kind of ask. You're not saying, give me money. You're welcoming them in into this community. At the same time, you're asking for them to help support it.
Do you have anything? All right. No questions. Yes, ma'am, in the back there.
I'm Amelia Ascari.
Oh, hey.
Co-chair for next year's conference.
Yeah, thank you.
And I am interested in brainstorming a little bit about
I mean, I got the grant last week from the Hearst Foundation, so I don't know if it's going to work, but I do. I mean, I have experience with it because we did it at the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, and many other places have followed that model. And, you know, it's a mission-driven model that also funds our – whoa, okay. That's like we're done. Yeah, so it's a mission. We can talk about it. I mean, I know other people have questions, but I'm happy to talk about it offline. But I think yes, I think it's I think it's an SEJ's mission big time. So.
Just how did the New England Center make money?
Oh, because we charge. So there's a lot. You know, there's the world is filled with high school students who want to have a leg up on a resume to get into a good college. And so our program is based at Boston University. It's an aspirational place for a lot of kids. Smart, talented kids would come and learn about journalism and pay a premium for that and live in the dorms, go to the Red Sox games, and really have a rigorous curriculum to learn about – it was investigative journalism we taught there. And, you know, go forth in the world and have those skills to, you know, ask questions and dig deeper. And I think the same thing can be done for environmental journalism and climate journalism. So we'll talk.
Yes, in the red.
That's got to be the last question.
Okay, that's the last
one. I'll be yelled at if I don't tell you.
Okay.
To wrap up.
Jay told me I could do 5 minutes later.
I'm the next moderator here, so I'll let
okay,
you go.
Okay, perfect. All right. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Mary Hoff from Axiom Magazine.
Oh, yeah.
So we had actually ended up having, I think, three or maybe four foundations that participated in the funding for that project. And typically we don't credit foundations or individual funders to a particular story unless they ask for it. So in that case, two of the foundations did. So we put a little sentence in at the end of the story that said that something like, you know, funding for this project was partially provided by, and then named all the funders.
That's good.
So you don't feel that's something that your readers need to know?
So our About Us pages are a mess right now because we switched over to a new CMS, and one of the things that our designers did was forget to put a lot of the pages back up, including the pages of our donor lists. Which we typically do include. So it wouldn't necessarily be tied to individual stories, but our annual reports have in the past, and they will in the future, include a list of all funders and donors. I probably will do it over $250, I think.
Right. Can I just mention something really quick about this? So foundations, not just foundations, but like the Fund for Investigative Journalism, and there's a few others out there, will underwrite stories. McGraw Fellowship gives a... $15,000 fellowship for stories, but it's hard to sometimes when there's a breaking story that you got to get on right away because they have timing deadlines, right? It takes time. You have to apply like December 15th for the next McGraw, you know, and so you have to have something that's very prospective and nothing immediate. And I just have a it's hard to get foundations or funders to support things in real time, and that I think is a problem. But we always write if we have. We try to go for unrestricted grants for general support because we think we know what we're doing and we want to, but occasionally I have to go and get money for like, we just had a investigation up in Alaska where we had the Fund for Investigative Journalism underwrite it. So we'll put a tagline at the bottom, say it. And it was, you know, and they did something very unusual. I asked them to operate to fund us out of cycle, and they did. And I think some funders are beginning to think about this because they realize we can't wait 6 months to do a story sometimes. So anyway. I have other ideas if you want smaller funders for stories.
All right. So I am being told that we should wrap up. But I would love to continue this conversation. There is going to be coffee and refreshments in the main ballroom. I'll be there. Perhaps some of these fine people will be there as well. So let's continue this conversation because I think it's really critical to what we're doing. And thank you so much for coming. And thank you guys for being here, too.